Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 500 people were murdered in Chicago last year. Many of those deaths attributed to gun and drug running among the city's estimated 70,000 gang members. Gang violence is no longer confined to urban street corners and neighborhoods. Nowadays, rivalries escalate with boasts, threats, and challenges made online. There's even a term for gangbangers who stir up trouble online: Facebook drillers. Ben Austin is a contributor to Wired, whose article, Public Enemies, covered how social media is fueling gang violence in Chicago and elsewhere. Ben, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Virginia.
So when you're talking about gang activity on social media, are we talking about organized gang presence on Twitter or Facebook, or individual members using social media the way pretty much everybody else does, to boast about themselves, except with higher stakes?
Yeah, I think both of those are actually exactly right. You know, kids in violent neighborhoods are like kids everywhere. They've grown up kind of showing their whole lives online. So if you're in a violent area that's proliferated with gangs, that's part of the world that you're going to project. But you're also seeing some more organized gangs, you know, doing things like recruiting, doing things like challenging other neighboring gangs, projecting power in a way that's going to intimidate people.
You tell us a particular story that has become part of gang lore in Chicago that pretty much begins with raps posted about gangs and their rivals on YouTube. Let's hear just a little from 300K by a rapper called Lil Jojo. Okay, so not so safe for radio, but the story is there. You know, there's a throwing down of the glove, let's say. There are a number of players involved here and a lot of back and forth, a lot of escalation. So could you just run through for us kind of the background of this story behind 300K?
Yeah, this is a story, like you said, that's really kind of become a touchstone in Chicago and elsewhere, that a rapper named Keith Cozart, a kid from the south side of Chicago, Englewood neighborhood, he goes by Chief Keith. He is on house arrest for aiming a gun at a police officer, and he uploads some songs to YouTube. They go viral, and he gets signed to a big contract, millions of dollars. So another local, Joseph Coleman, Little Jojo, whose song you just played, responds to him in a way, a kind of response song, maybe to feed off of his fame, you know, to build up fame. But as is what seems so different about these rappers and this music is that it's so explicitly tied to the gang culture. I mean, the songs are almost like anthems for their gangs. Chief Keef's song is one of them is called 300, which is a nickname for the Black Disciples. And the song you just played, BDK, which is Black Disciple Killers, is sort of a response, an attack song. And their videos, too, are just the video to the song you just played, Little Jojo and the people around him are just displaying hardware, guns, like it looks like a military exercise. I mean, there's so many guns in the image, in the frame. They're flashing gang signs. And then the other really strange phenomenon, the other part of this, is that the beef, the escalation, all happens online. They're not just the YouTube videos, but then back and forth Twitter feeds attacking one another, calling each other out, threatening one another, uploading videos where they're on one another's turf and showing that to projecting it to people in the neighborhood and anyone who wants to see it on this public site. And eventually Little Jojo calls one of these guys out and says exactly where he's going to be at a specific time. And he ends up being killed there, shot to death. And very soon after, Chief Keef sort of boasts on his Twitter site laughing about it. And so this becomes sort of a description of all these things that are going on in Chicago and other violent places where you have this kind of violent gang culture, but you also have something going on online which seems very different and new.
What you're describing here, Ben, is a real spillover from, you know, something that used to be throwing the dozens or whatever, just counteracting each other or brinksmanship with music, to this is actually transferred to gang violence on the street. What's interesting here is that that video is still up, that video of Lil Jojo, and people are still commenting on it and kind of claiming membership. So what do you think is behind this? What do you think is the motivation for saying, I'm part of this?
Yeah, I mean, so part of this is a real fragmentation of gangs in a place like Chicago. So to proclaim that you're a gang member and to show you and all your friends next to one another is something that would have never happened in the past. You know, the mafia doesn't allow you to say, here I am, I'm a member of the mafia. And in the past, you know, the disciples wouldn't have either. They would have violated you, a physical sort of punishment to kind of out everybody. But there aren't really leaders in the same way, or sort of, crime, the gang culture is much more disorganized than organized crime. There's a map in the Chicago Police Department that I saw when I was there of, like, 60 gangs divided into two easy categories. And now they're like 850 cliques, organized sort of just kind of kid gangs, organized by corners, organized by schools or parks. And without a kind of like older leadership, you get kids who are just kind of calling one another out in this way. And a lot of the violence isn't even, say, economic. It's not driven by, say, drug territory. It's driven sort of just by, these small beefs, the little, girlfriend, an area, you showed me up, so I'm going to show you up. And then the internet is kind of like this terrible, perfect medium to accelerate that kind of violence and spread it much more widely.
So rather than territory, does it matter how many followers one has? I mean, what are they really after? What's the goal?
Yeah, followers in not the sense, but, in the same way that you want to build up a reputation, that people always want to do this, that's the definition of having followers, or, Twitter followers or friends on Facebook, but you want to build a rep. You want to be known. And there's that kind of strange line between wanting to be, say, a rapper and a gangster. You want to be known, you want to be famous for one or the other. Sometimes the line between them becomes very blurry, like in this case.
We're speaking with Ben Austin, who wrote in Wired magazine about youth gangs in Chicago and how many of the members are using social media sites like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. As far as criminal strategy is concerned, however, something you alluded to earlier, it's not really smart to be boasting about or announcing where your gang activity is going to be taking place. I mean, why do these kids broadcast it all over social media?
Yeah, I mean, it's really brazen. Even someone like me, I'm not part of this culture, but you can very quickly kind of dig into this world with just a few search terms and get pretty far into it and see what's going on. In one sense, you have the police watching. Of course, they're watching. They better be if this is going on. But you can't necessarily prosecute someone for showing a gun in a YouTube video. You can't prove that it's real. It might be part of an investigation. But you do it for other reasons, too. One, like we were saying before, it's so much part of the culture if you grew up with this. But two, it does help. It does help kind of build your rep. It helps get followers. It helps recruit people. And if the goal is kind of just to threaten others and even to kind of protect yourself, then that works. I mean, one of the blurrier sides of this, which I think is really important to point out, that kids in this neighborhood who may be affiliated with a clique, sort of a youth gang, just by default, just by going to the same school or living on a block, they're not, say, hardcore criminals. They're there, and this is part of the culture. And it's almost like projecting a sense of power is a survival mechanism. Mm-hmm. That, I spoke to guys who said, if I don't show myself with guns on Facebook, then they're going to think that I'm an easy mark, an easy target. Then those guys are sort of picked out by the police as possible gang members, or also by enemies two blocks away who think they're also a gang member. So, this becomes the real problem of how tough it is to be, say, a 17-year-old boy in a lot of these neighborhoods.
You are writing about gangs in Chicago, and of course all of us have read, and heard so much news about all of the gang violence in Chicago over this past year. It's a story that we find extremely frightening, but also we have a deep curiosity, I think, about the rites and the rituals and the kind of all-in mentality of the gangs. I wonder if there's a risk, however, for us, giving them an audience. Does voyeurism play some kind of part in the online explosion of gang culture?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right that there's this kind of allure of this. And it could be anywhere. It's not just Chicago. Chicago has become sort of infamous in the last couple of years for a lot of its violence and its high homicide rate. But this is certainly everywhere. And an example of it is that, after little JoJo was killed, you had kids in states, like three and four states away, fighting one another and claiming to be members of those gangs in response to this shooting. So it spread that fast. I mean, when police in those areas called the Chicago police, the police in Chicago were befuddled that this had spread so far.
Well, Ben Austin, I really want to thank you for joining us. It's a wonderfully engrossing story and appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ben Austin is a contributor at Wired Magazine. He wrote about the rise of social media among the gangs of Chicago. His article is called Public Enemies, and we do have a link so you can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for more unconstructive online activity. We're going to hear about research on the nasty effect of negative comments and why Popular Science Online decided that was enough to disable online comments altogether. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a forum for conversation and debate and interaction, the internet may at times seem less public square and more like the Roman Forum, where sniping and shaming and mean-spirited insults can devour conversations and proclaim judgments by mob rule. Media outlets have long debated how best to moderate online comments, where some of the worst internet trolling takes place. Popular Science shut down comments on its website, citing in part a study from the University of Wisconsin measuring the influence negative comments have on other readers. We spoke with Dietram Schäufele, one of the authors of the study, back in March about the phenomenon he calls the nasty effect.
Well, a nasty effect is actually something that's very subtle in many ways. It's not something that relates to us making arguments or giving new information or trying to convince each other that we're right or wrong. But it's actually an effect that's simply based on the tone with which we do that. So the level of politeness or the lack of civility, for that matter, and how that really reshapes what we think we just read and what we've just learned.
Let's dig into that a little and talk about how your study was done. It was based on a fictitious post about a scientific study. Now, why? What was this particular story designed to reveal?
So what this story was all about, it described an aspect of nanotechnology, so this new technology that we invested billions and billions of dollars in as a country, and that has both upsides and downsides, potential risks associated with it, and a lot of course, economic and other benefits. And the study described those in a fairly balanced fashion. It was actually written by a science writer who we paid to write this very neutrally, and we gave them to a national sample of respondents, and everybody saw the exact same story. And that story then was followed by a set of comments. Those comments also, again, highlighted the pluses and the minuses, and the content, the arguments presented in the comments, again, were exactly the same. Everybody saw the same. The only difference was that some groups were exposed to a more civil version of this, and some people were exposed to a less civil or a more impolite version of this. So those folks heard the same arguments, but maybe there was an you idiot attack built into it. And that small tweak, just that level of politeness, changed how people then reinterpreted the story that they just read and also looked at the technology in a more negative light.
Huh. You found that it was actually more polarizing. People were more likely to take sides. Why does this occur? Any theories on that?
Well, I think it's in many ways it mirrors what we've seen in this country as far as the general discourse has been going. And I think if we just look back, for example, to the healthcare debate, the issue with the healthcare debate was not that we disagreed on the arguments in favor or against them. That was not the problem. Disagreement, in fact, is a very good thing, as a lot of research shows. But the issue with the healthcare debate was also the fact that we didn't just disagree with certain aspects. We also then proceeded to immediately call Obama, Hitler, or a Nazi, and whatever else. And the same thing, of course, worked on both sides. So I think it's really that tone that pushes us into our respective camps and makes us listen less to the other side or just discount that completely.
Dietram Schäufele there, science and communication professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His study on the nasty effect was published in February of 2013. In September, Popular Science decided to disable reader comments from its website, citing in part the nasty effect study. Jake Ward is editor-in-chief of Popular Science, and he's with us to talk more about that decision and the response so far. Jake, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
We just heard a bit about the study of the nasty effect. What else contributed to your decision to shut down comments from the Popular Science website?
You know, it was really a trio of factors. One was a rising tide of unpleasantness, right? One of the words that people use is trolls, which is people who get their kicks by sort of coming into chat rooms and just, you know, being uncivil in any way they can. Two was a rising sense that incivility can contribute to a misunderstanding of basic science, a skewing of people's perceptions of the issues, and a general sort of disservice to the mission of popular science. And then the third factor was just limited resources, because the truth of the matter is, I think you really can run an effective comment system on one's own site. It just takes an incredible number of resources to do it. And we discovered that if we didn't have the proper resources to do it, it would be irresponsible for us to just leave them unchecked.
Well, let's look at those points one at a time. What kinds of comments were you getting in general? Were they anti-science?
When it comes to the sorts of things that we found alarming, it's not so much that people are coming in and speaking their mind forcefully or that they disagree with the premise of the article or any of that stuff. That's the stuff we want. What we were getting was some really nasty stuff. Much of it is pretty unrepeatable, certainly on the radio. Mm-hmm. You know, not just the normal stuff, not just the stuff that you would imagine, like climate change or evolution, where, you have people with very deep-seated feelings about it. But, stuff about women's bodies, or stuff about contraception or whatever it was. You would get people writing really unspeakable things on a 140-year-old magazine site, that's supposed to be about science.
Popular Science's online editor, Suzanne Labarre, said, comments can be bad for science. Now, this statement from her has been well circulated and sort of seized upon as maybe a way of closing the door to conversation about science. How do you look at that a couple of weeks on? You've had some time to think about it. You've seen some responses.
You know, we really don't have any regrets. I mean, obviously, we're not insensitive to people's concern that we're sort of shutting off conversation. What I'd like to point out is that we're not shutting off conversation. There are a million ways in this day and age to get word back to us, and we're encouraging people to take that conversation to forums that we think are better for it, which include Facebook, Twitter, Google+. You know, there's a million ways to come back to us, and we track those things incredibly closely, and we're treating them as our de facto comments boards. The idea that it can be bad for science is not a question of people are bringing up, opposing points of view, and we don't want, and we're trying to shut those out. That's not the case at all. Like, we had a piece about contraceptive science, and someone wrote a very long pseudoscientific piece in their comment that laid out in very sort of dignified sounding terms a entirely imaginary case that condoms don't prevent venereal disease, and that the size of the particles that transmit the disease are in fact smaller than the openings in the condom. I mean, it was just this nonsensical thing, but it was very, very scary. And that was under a piece about contraceptive science. And so we had discovered that there's this rising body of study, including Dr. Schäuble's piece. There's a study out of Korea. You can very often conflate what is being said in the comments with what's being said in the article. And so for us to have people writing, some information that can be outright dangerous in a forum that we're not really equipped to manage properly means that, we really run the risk of there being some pretty hazardous information on our own site that we just, can't patrol.
Of course, all of us have seen nasty comments on the internet, and all of us have, been looking at a serious conversation and then learned that, somebody's cousin's brother is making $48 an hour working from home or, whatever gets posted on the internet. But I'm wondering if you think that the scientific community or the nature of science tends to provoke more nastiness for any reason. Are there more vested opinions in the world of science? Any observation there?
Well, I think that our readership is distinctive from others. I can't speak for any other publication, and not even for any other science publication. We're by no means saying that this is the way to go. We're not recommending it to anybody else. Part of the reason for that is that our readership is very, very distinctive. We're not like Scientific American, which I consider to be aimed at equal parts a sort of popular audience and a professional audience. There's a lot of working scientists that come to that site. Popular Science isn't a community of scientists as much as a community of lay people who are interested in science. Why it is that people might be interested in the inner workings of a nuclear weapon or a car or anything else that we cover and have a very, very clear-eyed view of that, but find themselves very, very upset at the idea that the evidence around climate change, in their view, doesn't add up. I can't explain human nature around that stuff. I don't really know it. All I know is that we need to be putting out the best science journalism with the most reputable sources we can. We're trying to do it right every single day. And so if we can't bring that standard to moderating the comments that go on underneath those stories, then we just figured it was more responsible not to happen at all.
Jake Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Popular Science, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Virginia.
The online version of Popular Science, popsci.com, disabled reader comments on its site. One of its claims was that comments can be bad for science. We'd like to know what you think. Should commenters and trolls be allowed free rein on the internet? Do you just ignore them, or are they impossible to ignore? We're at Word of Mouth on Twitter, or Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook, or you can let us know at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, this may sound like spam, but you can make millions selling stamps. An economist is going to walk us through this scheme and really give us a clever lesson in leveraging. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the break.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The United States Postal Service proposed plans to raise the price of a first-class stamp from 46 to 49 cents. The three-cent change should generate about $2 billion in additional revenue for an institution desperate to stem a projected $6 billion deficit just this year. Meanwhile, the Forever Stamp, introduced in 2006 and impervious to climbing rates, may present an unexpected opportunity for profit. Alison Schrager is an economist and writer whose work is featured regularly in Quartz, where she and Richie King co-wrote a step-by-step guide to making big money off the postal stamp's upcoming changes. Hi, Alison.
Hi.
So your secret is out. Let's begin to go through this step by step. Where's the opportunity and where do you begin?
Well, normally the price increase of forever stamps is supposed to be with inflation. And this year it's more, or they're proposing more, really just because the post office needs money so badly. But even if they were increasing it with inflation increases in theory continuously. But what they do is just overnight, they increase it a couple cents. So it's actually in real terms, which is just inflation adjusted terms, actually one large increase. So that's what presents the arbitrage opportunity. You know that a price is going to go up and you know this in advance and you know by exactly how much. So the idea is if you could buy many stamps, because obviously the margins are pretty low, like a couple cents a stamp, then you could flip them for the higher price. You know, the hard thing is one, we figure to even make tens of thousands of dollars, we need to buy 10 million stamps, which required $4.6 million, which we definitely don't have lying around. So we had to figure out how are we going to get all this money? And then how are we going to sell all these stamps, both of which are really hard? We didn't really do this, but what we propose you do is you raise a little bit of seed funding in the equity market. And then what we did is we bought a bunch of stamps with that, took them to a bank and offered them as collateral, and did this several times until we got $4.6 million. But the thing is, you want to sell the stamps then right after the price increase as quickly as possible, because every week you're having this bank loan, you have to pay interest on it. So if it takes you 2 years to sell all these stamps, you'll probably lose money. And for our scheme to work, you would need to sell these stamps well under 2 months.
So what would you sell them for? 47, 48 cents?
Yeah, ideally 48 cents because it's a bigger profit. Mm-hmm. But we're open to the idea that you maybe will offer a bulk discount for someone who would maybe, you know, take a million stamps at once.
Where can you buy a million stamps at once, Alison?
Well, you can buy a million stamps from the post office, but what we need are people who actually will demand a million stamps from us. And so what we were thinking were places like Walgreens or CVS or local bodegas who sell stamps for a high markup, like 60 cents, just because a lot of people don't have time to go to the post office because they can sell them at a large markup and they might actually need many stamps.
You mentioned having to come up with $4.6 million to buy 10 million stamps. How much would we earn on that?
Well, we figured you could earn well over 100,000%. So yeah, between Richie and I, we got $58,550.
Wow.
You know, what's interesting is you can buy up to 1 million stamps from the post office and only spend $1.75 in postage to get them shipped to you, which was an interesting tidbit in itself. But we couldn't buy all our stamps at once, obviously, because we had to get the loans from the bank, get more stamps, post them as collateral, get another loan. We never actually were able to confirm that a bank would actually take stamps as collateral. I think we're still might be doing some wishful thinking on that. But in principle, you know, it's, you know a forever stamp what that's worth, and they take collateral, much riskier asset. So maybe. So we figured we'd have to buy 19 stamps 19 different times for $1.75 each. Richie and I decided we would be able to front the shipping cost of the stamps, which after 19 different shipments would be $33.25. And based on that, we got our $58,550.
Allison, this is all a thought experiment at this point, right? You know, the stamps haven't gone up or anything. More people find out about this. You're not going to have the market on stamps. I mean, why are you sharing this foolproof get-rich-quick scheme on Quartz?
Well, you know, it is an interesting thought experiment. And as an economist, I thought it would be interesting to illustrate to people leverage. And, you know, what we really did is we took a very highly leveraged position. And when you take on a lot of financial leverage, we made, you know, we had over 100, almost a 200,000% profit. If we just had $4.6 million and could have bought the stamps ourselves, we'd only get about a 4% profit.
How often do I think, if I just had $4.6 million to invest, is this something that economists like you think about in your spare time?
Oh, yeah, all the time. We're sick people.
Allison, I want to thank you for all of your clever tips.
Thank you.
Allison Traeger is an economist and writer whose work is regularly featured in Quartz. You can link to her step-by-step guide to profiting off the 3% postage stamp hike, which she co-wrote with Richie King. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. If you don't have the scratch to buy 10 million stamps, here's a way to make a buck. Joel Eastwood of the Toronto Star wrote about savvy students at the University of Toronto registering for classes and then selling those spots to students who need that particular course but can't get in.
Once a course is full, there's a wait list, but toward the end of, after about a few weeks into the first day of class, that wait list ends. And then there's a very brief period of about a week between when the wait list ends and when nobody else can apply or drop classes. And during that period, it's essentially anything goes. It's every man for himself.
The haggling begins on social media. Prices range from $20 to $100. That's at least what one student offered for a spot in the history of modern espionage.
Essentially, the market has expanded considerably because now if somebody wants to, quote unquote, sell their spot in the course, their potential buyers aren't just their close friends. Their potential buyers are anyone in a school of 50,000 people.
If making a market out of class placement seems ethically slippery to you, you are not alone. The University of Toronto says it cannot stop the selling of spots, but it has put safeguards in place to prevent anyone from getting rich in the trade.
The university did say that they cap the number of courses one student can enroll in precisely to prevent somebody from having early registration, stocking up on all the key classes, and then just selling them off once the opportunity arises.
Whether it's shorting the stamp market or selling a seat in Psych 101, markets find a way. Thank you to the Toronto Star's Joel Eastwood for talking with us. You can read his article about students selling seats at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. These days, enticing kids to pursue careers in science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as STEM, is integral to a school's curriculum. U.S. educators are on the lookout for unique ways to get kids excited about science. Robotics competitions are one way to accomplish that task. Allison Quantz followed one team into competition as they fought to call themselves Lego Robotics Champions.
All right, in three, two, one, Lego!
With that countdown, Southwest Virginia's first Lego League robotics competition begins.
This is my fourth year, and I've been to state twice.
Ali Qureshi is a member of the Ninja Stars, a team sponsored by the University of Virginia College at Wise. As part of the competition, they've built and programmed a tabletop robot that can complete different tasks, like bowling. Here's Noah Sturgill, another Ninja Star.
Right now, they're doing a bowling mission. They've got an arm that flings a ball and tries to knock down as many pins as possible. You see, what just now happened, one of my fellow teammates, Grayson, just got hit with the ball.
The kids use a computer program that uses blocks to tell the robots what to do. Ali, the unofficial team captain, tries to explain how it works.
There's a whole bunch of blocks, and each block tells your robot to do a simple movement, like go forward two rotations, or turn 90 degrees, or lift the arm up.
The teams are also responsible for writing a skit that includes creative technology solutions for real-world problems faced by seniors. The Ninja Star skit features a robot that can schedule doctor's visits and find lost keys.
Watch as the NinjaSoft senior assistant warns the senior about a gas leak, aids the senior in leaving the building, and calls the fire department.
Sir, I have detected high levels of carbon monoxide. Let's move you to a safe location.
For these kids, working with robotics technology feels natural. Dr. Abrar Qureshi is a professor at UVA Wise and one of the coaches for the Ninja Stars.
They don't even feel like they are doing it, but they are learning how to solve problems and how to deal with those, how to analyze those situations, and then how to come up with the solutions. And that's what we do in the real world.
Other coaches echo similar thoughts. Sarah Hampton is a math teacher at Sullins Academy in Bristol. She believes letting kids experiment with this technology can help them more than a textbook.
Sometimes the students learn more in Lego robotics than they do in the classroom setting because it's so hands-on and it's very much student-centered rather than an instructor telling them how to do it. They have to figure out their own problems.
The Ninja Stars from UVA Wise finished the day on top, and soon they'll be headed to the Virginia State Robotics Competition. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
When Christopher Hermlin moved to New York City, he lived like countless other jobless 20-somethings. No prospects, no money, and rent due at the first of the month. But instead of kicking around in a cafe, he hit the streets with a $10 typewriter and a sign printed, "Stories While You Wait," sliding scale, donate what you can. And it worked. Passersby paid him to write one-of-a-kind stories on the spot. While he isn't the only person to make his living like this on the streets of New York, he is the one person whose photograph showed up on the internet. We're going to let him pick up the story from there. So, Christopher Hermlin, the roving typist, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I guess your troubles began when this photo of you showed up on the internet. First, describe the photo and what you thought when you first saw it.
The photo is, it's of me typing on the High Line, and it's from the side of me where you can't see that I have a sign. So I think that that's where the problem started. And I'm wearing, you know, summer clothing, which is short shorts and a gray shirt, which was mostly because the humidity in New York is absolutely insane. So I was wearing shoes without any laces. So all of these things put together, plus my $10 Royal Safari typewriter on my lap, did not have the greatest combined effect, I guess. the morning that people told me that it hit the front page of Reddit, I was like, ah, shoot, I do kind of look insane.
Well, Reddit users had a pretty cruel response to the photo. What were some of the things that they said? And keep in mind, you have to make them safe for radio.
Oh, you know, get out of my city, and that's edited, was the one that seemed to be the most prevalent response, as well as, you know, just sort of hipster scumbag was the other sort of popular rallying cry.
I never wanted to fist fight someone so badly in my entire life, was one comment on Reddit. Why do you think it produced so much online ire?
Well, I think it tied really well into the internet's hatred of hipsters. I was dressed in a way that looks hipsterish, I suppose, although a lot of people think that the clothes are very expensive for some reason. Mm-hmm. The clothes are really down market. Like, I think I'm wearing H&M clothing, and I think I bought the shoes at a thrift store. So there's just like a lot of implied things by what I was doing, that I was a hipster, that I was part of this social movement that co-opts other social movements and pretends like it was their own and that they got there first. And I think that that is what people responded to. It didn't have a lot to do with me. It was more to do with what I represented and what I was wearing.
Okay, so how long did this brush with internet, I guess, infamy last?
Well, you know, it's a year and a half later and I'm still talking about it.
Well, it looks like it disappeared pretty much from Reddit in about 12 hours, but somebody made a meme that said, you know, you're not a real hipster until you've taken a typewriter to the park. How did people who you know respond to this? Because it seems like it keeps cycling around.
My friends were really excited, actually, just because I was everywhere for a little bit on Pinterest boards and on Facebook. And people were sharing it amongst my high school and my college, just like, oh, do you remember this guy? Like, here he is showing up again all over on the internet. So my closest circle of friends were trying to figure out ways for me to like capitalize on it. And I didn't know how to do that.
You didn't know how to do it? I mean, you're talking to me on the radio. You've talked to a lot of different people. I mean, let's face it, Christopher, a lot of people look for this kind of attention, right? They'd love a photograph of them to go viral in the no press is bad press kind of thinking, you know, it doesn't matter if it's not that flattering.
That's true. I knew I wanted to write about it in some way, but I didn't know how to actually do it. I don't write a lot of nonfiction myself, and I rarely ever talk about myself other than through like the various gradations of fiction writing. So I think I was just sort of scared to actually put my thoughts about it onto paper, because I think it would make the whole experience real and I'd actually have to figure out what I thought about it, when I was doing a much better job just brushing it off and pretending like it didn't matter to me, and then going home and reading more comments.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Could you help yourself but read these comments?
I couldn't. I know that it's a compulsion at this point, and I'm definitely better at it now. But back then, you know, that was the first time I'd ever had any response to anything I'd done online in that way. So I couldn't stop reading it because I wanted to know what a majority of people who didn't know me thought about me. Uh-huh. I think that would be a human response. I don't think that that's totally crazy.
Right, that we drive stakes into our hearts one comment at a time. Yeah. But I'm wondering, Christopher, if somebody walked by you and said, hey, roving typist, tell a story about me. I'm a guy who had his picture on the internet, went viral. Everybody seemed to hate me. I'm living with it now. What'd the story sound like?
The story sounds unbelievable, to tell you the truth. It just seems sort of like, it just seems sort of insane. Every time that I retell it, I start to feel like it sounds less and less real. So if someone asked me to write that story, I would be like, that is a great imagination. I did not know that like it could take so many turns.
Christopher Hermlin, the roving typist, thank you for telling us your story.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher became an object of internet ridicule after a photo of him went viral online. He wrote about the experience on theall.com, and we do have a link to his website where you can order your own one-of-a-kind story at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we've heard plenty today about the internet's power for good and evil. It is, of course, a reflection of the human beings who use it. Here at Word of Mouth, we look to it as a tool for exploration, wonder, and communication. And that means with you. You can find us at Word of Mouth on Twitter. You can find us on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, and find convenient ways to hear or share stories on your own time and get in touch with us at wordofmouthradio.org. After all, stories are best told via word of mouth, and we would love to hear yours.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah.